Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. We're going to start with an article from AARP, the magazine. Upfront, the A-list, seven things Judy Blume wants to try right now. One, take yourself seriously. When I started writing, "Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret," I was this suburban mom, and everyone, including my then husband, thought, "Oh, isn't that cute? She thinks she's a writer." But I didn't see it as cutesy, and I got mad at anyone who did. Two, stand up for reading. We went through a period of book banning in the 80s, and here we are again. Mine get banned because they're about the inner lives of tweens, including sexuality. I tell people, unless you say why these books are important to you, they're going to be gone. You'd better make your voice heard. Three, tap your troubles away. There is a lot of luck involved in how we age. With me, the hips, the knees, they haven't gone yet. Maybe because I keep moving. When I was 45, I took up tap dancing, and I became obsessed. You're slapping those feet around, and it's just wonderful. Four, trust your gut. One night in 2018, I noticed that my husband George looked yellow. He said he would go to the doctor soon. I said, "No, now." George had pancreatic cancer. He is one of the very, very lucky ones who has survived. Five, color your world. Here's my trick for looking my best on Zoom. I have a pink light. Under pink light, everyone looks great. Six, hold out. People have been trying to buy the film rights for Are You There, God? For 50 years. But I hated the way American filmmakers portrayed tween kids, too sexy or too cutesy. Director Kelly Freeman, Greg, and producer Jim Brooks wanted to get it right. The film is just what I envisioned. It was worth wait. Seven, find purpose. My Uncle Bernie used to say that the key to a happy retirement is to get up every day and know what you're going to do. So, George and I got a bookstore. We didn't have a clue what we were in for, but it satisfies my need to be involved in something new and different. It keeps my life exciting. This article was as told to Judith Newman. Judy Blume is the author of 29 books and the co-founder of Books and Books at the studios of Key West, Florida. A film of her classic novel, Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, is planned for release next April. Now, also from AARP, the magazine, Upfront Live. Dear Iron, I'm breaking up with you. A veteran fashion designer or writer has joined the movement against putting hot metal to fabric. There was a time when the iron was woven into the rumpled fabric of family life. This humble appliance would be brought out regularly, along with ceremonious popping into position of the ironing board to smooth the church dress, crease a pair of work trousers, or unwrinkle fancy cloth napkins. In my childhood home, even my father's jeans had to be neatly pressed into perfection. Now my iron is hidden on a high shelf in my laundry room. I no longer own an ironing board. While sales of irons are on the decline, garment steamers have picked up steam. This product category is predicted to grow to $2.5 billion in sales by 2025, according to the market research firm Ariston. And why not? Steamers are faster, more portable, don't require the space of an ironing board, and can't scorch fabrics. There's even some evidence that steamers have health benefits. Last year, a report by the Insight Partners, a consumer research group, pointed out that various tests show that steam can kill 99.9% of bacteria, germs, and viruses. But those aren't the only iron's only threats. Easy Care Fabric technology has improved to the point that few clothes need such meticulous care. To find pants that require an iron today, you'd almost have to seek them out. The sustainability movement has created a desire for the natural, real, and imperfect, says Laurie Wilson, an instructor of fashion studies at the University of Cincinnati. The starched and pressed look is not current. At home, Wilson is more likely to opt for a spray-on wrinkle releaser or to put the clothes into the dryer on the wrinkle release setting. Why iron if you don't have to? Now let's look at AARP, the bulletin. This is an older issue, but I think it's an important topic. The new truth about aging. Throw out the stereotypes. An exclusive, wide-ranging study reveals how older Americans are redefining health, defying their challenges, and living with purpose. In late 2021, journalists at the National Geographic magazine and AARP discussed working together to explore how Americans perceive aging as we emerge from the COVID pandemic. That began a research collaboration focused on asking people like you questions that would probe the full breadth of aging issues, from health and finances to attitudes about happiness, home, optimism, and even dying. To make the study as useful as possible, we posed the same questions to Americans from aged 18 into their 90s to see how opinions vary over the arc of adulthood. More than 2,500 people participated, representing the full range of America's backgrounds, demographics, and ethnicities. Another 25 adults, 40 and older, participated in in-depth interviews. Many of the often surprising results of the AARP/National Geographic second half of life study are in your hands. In my hands, anyway. No single sentence can capture the gist of all that people told us, but we can say with confidence that most prevalent opinions and stereotypes of aging were proven wrong. Overall, the message was refreshingly positive and reassuring. On the whole, life is good, especially for older Americans, especially those over 60. And the person you see in the mirror is far different from the type of person younger generations might think you are. Here is what you told us about aging today. Not only conclusions from the data, but also comments from study participants who shared their first names only, as well as from leading experts on aging-related topics. Now, this is a very long article, so we will start on it today, but we'll continue for several weeks. This is part one, health redefined. Longevity pill? Maybe. The survey posed this tantalizing proposition. Would you take a pill that immediately granted 10 bonus years of life? While around 3/4 of adults across all age ranges said they likely would take such a pill, one interesting finding was that those 80 and older were the least interested. And when the question was posed without an age guarantee, but instead cited the promise of slower aging with extended health, the likelihood shot up to around 85%. Age is just a number that's assigned to me, says study participant Jackie, age 56. I would like to live as long as I possibly can and enjoy it, but I don't want to be old and not be able to function. I want to be healthy. Assume for a moment that there was a pill that could likely extend your life by 10 years. How likely would you be to take that pill? At least somewhat likely. 18 to 39-year-olds, 72%. 40 to 49-year-olds, 78%. 50 to 59, 80%. 60 to 69, 80%. 70 to 79, 78%. And 80 plus, 70%. Assume for a moment that there was a pill that could slow down aging and maintain your health longer. How likely would you be to take that pill? Well, 18 to 39 is 82%, 40 to 49 is 81%, 50 to 59 is 88%, the 60s is 87, the 70s is 87, and 80 plus was 81%. Healthy with conditions is the new norm. Conventional takes on physical well-being often are presented as either or. Either you're healthy or you're sick. But about 2 out of 3 people in their 50s and 8 out of 10 in their 80s are living with one or more serious or chronic health conditions. And despite their arthritis, cancer, diabetes, heart disease, or other conditions, 78 to 83% rated their health good, very good, or excellent. That's a survival benefit to resilience. People can reframe their situation and make the best of it, says Susan Friedman, MD, a professor in the Division of Geriatrics and Aging at the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry. And she adds, health is multidimensional. That's how Ruth, a study participant in her 90s, sees it. She still sings in a church choir and plays table tennis, despite using a walker. Good health is being able to get up each day and do the things that you plan to do and not dread them, she says. Timothy, 51, has a similar view. This study participant has immunity challenges and a few years ago survived a month in the hospital. Now, he says, you just wake up in the morning, you eat a handful of pills, and you go about your day. You don't let it overwhelm your mind. How would you rate your overall health? These people rated it very good or excellent. 18 to 39, 42%. The 40s, 37%. The 50s, 39%. The 60s, 44%. The 70s, 49%. And the 80 pluses, 49%. So from now on, I'm not going to give you all of the percentages. I'll just give you an overview of them. With age come blueberries and walking shoes. I currently take steps to achieve this goal. The lowest group was the 18 to 39s at 62%, and the highest was the 70s at 78%. 80 plus is 75%. Maintain a healthy heart. The 18 to 39s with the lowest at 57, and the 80 pluses the highest at 86%. Maintain a healthy weight. That was least important to the 40s, people in their 40s, at 60%. Most important to people in their 80s at 74%. Maintain physical stamina. Least important to those in their 40s at 54%. Most important to those in their 80s at 73%. Perhaps in an effort to delay the day when they face mental decline or lack of mobility, older people are often models of healthy living that younger generations should emulate. In her 70s, Lillian avidly reads nutrition labels, opts for steaming or air frying over fried foods and oil, because frying is not good for you. She takes vitamins and is thrilled that a relative is giving her an exercise bike for her apartment. Similarly, Robin, 64, takes her 3 dogs for a daily walk and then heads out again. I go for another walk with my husband. Maybe we'll go walking with friends. If the weather is not nice, I go on my treadmill and do exercises over the TV. I see exercise as one way to stay healthy. An aside here, they even pump more iron. An impressive 44% of people 80 or older say they do strength training, making them as serious about muscles as the youngest in the study. Richard, 70, is an example. I have a black belt and am trained in hand-to-hand combat, which I started at age 55, he says. Before COVID hit, I was still doing CrossFit and kickboxing. The 80-plus folks' motivation? Many correctly equate muscle strength with mobility and independence, Friedman says. The Good Life Equation, a sharp brain, plus close relationships, plus independence. All these new notions about health were reinforced in the study when we asked about what health issues people worry about most. Respondents feared loss of mobility and mental decline far more than life-threatening but less symptomatic issues like diabetes and heart disease. Even if they have health issues, they're really worried about, can I still move? Am I still mentally sharp? Can I still connect with and see my family? Says Deborah Whitman, Chief Public Policy Officer for AARP. That's a powerful message that the medical community and even family members and caregivers don't always hear when advising older people on important health decisions, such as undergoing a major medical procedure. It shouldn't be treatment at all costs, Whitman says. Geriatricians are at the forefront of having these conversations, asking the patient what's meaningful for them and understanding the impact. Recovery time is hard. It's really important to talk to patients and understand the implications for their independence. And next time, we'll look at part two, which is money perceptions. Now, let's go back to the Complete Guide to Memory, which we have ignored for a couple of weeks, but let's get back to it now. We're at the section called Freeze Frame. Our flashbulb memories of dramatic public events are vivid, but often inaccurate. We have a couple of sidebar comments here. Shared collective memories often feel so solid in our minds, they could be captured on film. But while these recollections are intense, the details they contain can be incorrect. And for those looking up in New York City as two jets slammed into the World Trade Center, the visual was one of the most terrifying and shocking things they had ever seen. Where were you on September 11th, 2001, when you first heard that a plane had hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center in New York? Many of us may have vivid memories of that day, recalling where we were and what we were doing when we first heard of the attack. Perhaps even remembering seemingly irrelevant details. Chances are that memory isn't as accurate as you might think it is. This is called a flashbulb memory. Researchers coined the term in 1970 as a metaphor for capturing an entire scene in one moment, from the most important to the most mundane details, and then being able to hold on to that memory indefinitely as if you had a photographic record of it. Flashbulb memories have intrigued memory researchers like me for a long time. We know that they are a type of autobiographical memory, memories of personally experienced events. Like other autobiographical memories, we think we remember them accurately. In reality, we often don't. While we know that flashbulb memories aren't perfect records, for a long time no one knew if these memories were more accurate than ordinary autobiographical memories. Since flashbulb memories are often formed after sudden dramatic events, it's hard to create experiments to test this. I was a graduate student at Duke University on September 11th. My advisor, David Rubin, and I instantly recognized the opportunity to conduct a study of flashbulb memories in response to this event. On September 12th, we asked our undergraduates about their memories of how they learned about the terrorist attacks, as well as an ordinary autobiographical memory from the preceding weekend. In the months afterwards, we were able to follow up with our undergrads to see if and how these memories changed. You think you remember it exactly, but you don't. While the term flashbulb memory was introduced in 1977, the phenomenon was known to researchers well before then. In fact, in 1899, psychologist F.W. Colgrove recorded vivid and detailed memories from people about when they learned of President Abraham Lincoln's assassination, which had happened decades earlier in 1865. For a long time, researchers argued that flashbulb memories really were a complete and accurate snapshot of events. Ulrich Neisser a pioneering cognitive psychologist, drew on a flashbulb memory of his own to suggest that this wasn't the case in 1982. Here is how he described his memory of learning about the attack on Pearl Harbor. I recall sitting in the living room of our house. We only lived in that house for 1 year, but I remember it well, listening to a baseball game on the radio. The game was interrupted by an announcement of the attack, and I rushed upstairs to tell my mother. Years later, after reading scientific research on flashbulb memories, he realized that this memory had to be wrong. Pearl Harbor was attacked on December 7, 1941, and there is no baseball on the radio in December. This realization led him to explore the accuracy of flashbulb memories. In 1986, he and his collaborator, Nicole Harsh, asked a group of undergraduates to recall how they learned of the Challenger space shuttle disaster the morning after it happened. Much like earlier reports, they found that almost all of the students had detailed memories of, quote, exactly where they were and what they were doing when they found out about the explosion. Neisser and Harsh did something that other researchers hadn't done before. They asked participants to recall the same event a few years later. They found that although everyone still had vivid and complete memories, some of the memories had changed quite remarkably. In fact, 25% of participants reported different memories altogether, such as first describing having learned from a fellow student in class and years later saying they saw it on a TV news bulletin with their roommate. This meant that the vividness and confidence that participants had shown were not related to the actual accuracy of their memories. And the errors that flashbulb memories develop are not random. Our emotions and sense of belonging to a group can color them. For instance, Neisser was probably listening to a football game on the radio when he heard about Pearl Harbor. He argued that the switch from football to baseball served to emphasize his personal connection to the national pastime at a time when the nation to which he was an immigrant had been attacked. And a 2005 study found that Danes remembered the day when Denmark surrendered to Germany in World War II as being colder, cloudier, windier, and rainier than it truly was, and the day when Denmark was liberated from Germany as being warmer, sunnier, less windy, and less rainy than it truly was. While these studies demonstrate that flashbulb memories aren't completely accurate, they don't test whether flashbulb memories are more accurate than memories of everyday events. That was the question that my colleague and I sought to address in the wake of the September 11th attack. On September 12th, Ruben and I asked a group of 54 undergraduates questions about how they learned about the attacks. We asked questions about the memory, like, how did you learn the news? Where were you? What were you doing? And who were you with? We also asked questions about the feeling of remembering, like how clearly can you see this event in your mind's eye? And how strongly do you believe that the event actually happened in the way that you were remembering it? We also asked participants the same questions about another memorable event from the weekend before the attacks. By doing so, we could compare how flashbulb memories and ordinary memories of life events change over time. We then asked subgroups of our participants the same questions, either 1 week, 1 month, or 7 months later. By recruiting subgroups at each time point, each person only told us about their memories twice, but we were able to observe how memories changed over three distinct time periods. Flashbulb and ordinary autobiographical memories were very consistent over the course of 1 week, but 1 month, and certainly by 7 months, both memories showed fewer consistent details between the two reports. The rate of that forgetting was the same for both groups, for both types of memories. We also found that errors like the introduction of new or contradictory information, were introduced at about the same rate in both types of memories. So what is the difference between flashbulb memories and autobiographical memories? Our beliefs about those memories. People believed that their flashbulb memories were more accurate than the ordinary memory we ask them to recount. They felt that they remembered the flashbulb memory more vividly as well. And it's this difference in perception that makes flashbulb memories so remarkable. Why we believe? So why do we believe that these flashbulb memories are more accurate than other memories? For example, of American students, the attacks of September 11th were highly emotional and dominated not just national discourse, but also private conversations for days, weeks, months later. These processes serve to enhance the vividness of our memories and our subjective confidence in those recollections. Furthermore, by virtue of having these long-lasting and detailed memories of significant events, we can demonstrate and reinforce our membership in these important social groups. In other words, community exhortations to never forget serve to maintain memories, not just collectively, but in each of us alone. Now, from AARP, the Bulletin, we have time for some more money-saving tips. And this one is for food gardeners. Hold a seed swap. Unless you have a truly large garden, it is rare to use up a full packet of seeds. And it's always best to plant seeds the same year you purchase them, rather than storing them for future seasons. The solution? Connect with neighbors or friends who garden and coordinate your seed buying, with the goal of sharing packets and cutting costs. Now, car costs. A gallon of gas in the U.S. averaged just over $3 in May of 2021. 1 year later, it had increased to over $4.50. So, brake less, coast more. Think of driving this way. Every time you brake, you waste the gas you just used to get to your current speed. The more you can coast or avoid the surging and slowing of crowded traffic, the higher your gas mileage will be. Get in the habit of accelerating gently, coasting toward red lights and stop signs, and trying to use brakes a little less. A secondary benefit, you'll be driving more safely, which could save insurance dollars and perhaps collision repairs. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, call 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.